John really indirectly suggested what he was talking. He suggested anyhow to me, though he didn't mean to at the time, that we discuss some theological matters that were brought up as questions really last hour in a sort of a dialogue this hour, psychologically and theologically. And the thing that I'd like to start with, and I sort of ask him if he'd react to, psychologists have now, since at least the year 1900, when Freud published his book, Interpretation of Dreams, been very concerned about man's relationship to his unconscious mind, which is revealed to him mostly through symbols. And Freud began here talking about the Oedipus story as one kind of a myth that could have deeper psychological meaning if we take the symbol of Oedipus, for instance, to stand for the little boy in the phallic stage instead of just a man. And the story then takes on much greater hidden meaning. Freud also introduced the possibility of exploring other myths in trying to get at the unconscious symbolism. And though he never did it himself, he suggested to some of his disciples, notably Carl Jung and then Theodor Reich and Otto Rank, some of these noted psychologists, the possibility of doing this to many cultural myths, including the Adam and Eve story. Now, they never have really gotten too far themselves with this story, but what I've sort of done, and did this just on a very personal basis, was take together everything they've said and make a unified theory out of it. And we did this, I think, a week or two ago here. And I want to do it sort of over again, the first 10 or 15 minutes, and then discuss whether or not this says anything theologically that might be acceptable or unacceptable to the theologians of John Milton, like Augustine and Tillich, and I forget the other ones that he was mentioning. So let me just start like this. I'm going to assume that you all know the story, and I'll start writing with the symbolism so I don't waste time telling the story. Or can I do that? Let me briefly go through this story. Let's
never assume knowledge of the Bible among Lutherans.
Well, let me tell a story then, and if I leave out any essential parts, someone can throw it in and we'll do that too. The story goes like this, and there are really two basic parts to the story. Adam is put into the Garden of Eden alone. The Garden of Eden is a warm, wonderful place where the presence of God is there, but he's alone yet, and he asks, or at least if he doesn't ask for it, God suggests to him that he has a helpmate and creates a helpmate for Adam. He takes Eve out of Adam's ribcage and he is their divine form. Adam and Eve then go through this little plot. A serpent, they've been forbidden by God to eat of the tree of knowledge of fruit and evil.
That's not a pathological.
After they've been given this no-no, a snake comes and says to Eve that she should eat of this, that it will make her godlike. So therefore, for a selfish reason, rather than for an unselfish reason, Eve eats this fruit, shares this fruit with Adam, and after they're done sharing this fruit together, they realize that they're naked, they become ashamed, they clothe themselves, they're then expelled from the Garden of Eden, at which entrance, or exit as the case may be, an angel with a flaming sword is put to ensure that they can never return. Now, this is the essential story. There are a few other symbols we're going to talk about, like the four rivers flowing in and out of Eden, but...
Don't forget the passage where he tries to blame it all on Eve.
Right. He says it's the fault of woman. And all these things that we discussed now about a week ago, but I want to do it again rather quickly and then get to theological reaction. The story goes, now, first two things that you must understand. In symbolic interpretation, especially the rules of dream interpretation, as laid out by Freud in his book, Interpretation of Dreams, we're using especially two rules. One of them is the rule of condensation, which states that a symbol may refer to more than one reference. You see that it stands for many things at one time. Another one is what he calls the rule of contiguity, that when things occur in a chronological sequence in a dream or in a myth, this does not mean that they have to be interpreted in a chronological order. It merely means that contiguity here implies association of ideas. So when one thing happens before another in a dream, you might interpret it as the last thing having happened first, but it does mean that these two ideas must necessarily be on the same subject matter. See, that's, and Freud goes into this in quite a bit of detail in some of his writing, but especially interpretation and dream. Now, with those two rules in mind and the basic story, we begin our interpretation, and let me summarize the interpretation first and then go into it in detail. This is a story of man from the time he is conceived until the time he is born at first. Then it talks about the basic nature of man after birth. And this is essentially what the story means. The Garden of Eden is a womb symbol. You see, when the story begins, it says, in the beginning. And this is to be taken to refer to the beginning of individual human life rather than the beginning of the universe in this psychological interpretation. So that when man is conceived, he was created in the image and likeness of God. This is taken to mean that man is God-like. He's in the presence of God. There's love all around him in the Garden of Eden. He's in the presence of God. In the womb, he's also surrounded by love of mother. The psychologists know he's entirely subjective at this time, and even right after birth. And his union with the mother is psychologically complete. This is an aquatic environment, much as the Garden of Eden is, with the four rivers flowing in and out. Freud himself interprets the river symbolism always to mean one of two things. It either means that out of which a person is born. So when a person has a dream of emerging from the sea onto a desert island, it's a symbol of birth. Or otherwise, if he dreams about a river and it's a canal of water, you see a river, he says this is the physiological place which is the beginning of the birth process, meaning conception. In other words, he's talking about the reproductive process, this being the woman's sexual part, the reproductive organ. Now notice that the Garden of Eden and the womb have many things in common. The person need not toil for his food. It's given to him, you see, in both places, without toil. Later on, it's when he toils for his food. It's a perfect climate. Everything is made without really any frustration. Everything that's necessary for life is provided. And he's in the presence of this love, which the symbol for God here is this all-encompassing love of the mother that not only gives him life, but sustains it. Okay, this is the basic symbolism then of the Garden of Eden. Now, in the dream then, and here we use this principle of continuity rather than chronology, man is expelled from the Garden of Eden, or he's expelled from the womb. And angels are put then at the entrance of the womb guarding it, but he always had a desire to return. Well, when you know about the birth process, you realize that this in itself is a very difficult thing for human beings to go. It's a separation of the human from his mother, as the Bible puts it, a separation of man from God. And it's at birth, not at conception, but at birth, psychologically. See, the question that I ask is, what about the doctrine of the fall? The theologians have said that original sin happens at creation. The psychologist would say original sin happens at birth, not at conception. That from conception till birth, he's in the Garden of Eden, and he's good. He's in the image and likeness of God, he's surrounded by love. But what happens when separation occurs, or at birth, this is the fall. Man is separated from his source of love and that which sustains his life. And it's a real psychological kind of separation. And then Adorando, of course, talks about birth trauma and really goes into this in some detail. But if you notice this even physiologically, you witness a birth, and you notice that there's a real symbolism here about an angel with a flaming sword guarding the entrance that the baby might not come back. For one thing, it's a very inflamed area, the mother's perineum, for instance. Really, we talk about it even as being inflamed. For another thing, there's quite an issue of blood that could very well be symbolic of this. You see, fire and blood very commonly have the same kind of symbolism. Not only that, but it's impossible for the child ever to go back in. The fontanelles on his head, there are six of them, allow for expansion, or actually I suppose contraction, so that the head can be pressed into a raindrop-like shape as it goes through the birth canal. But after birth already, the head starts to, the skull begins to ossify, so that the head no longer can contract this way, and the kid will never be able to again enter the womb. You see, the entrance is guarded. He will not fit back in. But the psychologists say he always has a desire to re-enter the womb. And this brings up the next part of the story. Because of man's desire to re-enter the womb, you see, this becomes symbolic then of the way that human beings do, in a sense, symbolically re-enter the womb through sexual relationship. That in a sense, the man really is re-entering the womb this way. The gate of the womb, or the gate of the Garden of Eden, is really being entered by the man. It's his desire. And this is where the second part of the interpretation of the story occurs. That a snake has, we'll just go through this part of the story. A snake tempts a naked woman to share the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil with the naked man, and after they do this, they're ashamed. What the symbolism here is that the snake is a sexual symbol, a phallic symbol, who tempts the woman, who now is doing an act that's been forbidden by God, so it's therefore a selfish one. The psychologists know that when sex is indulged in for selfish reasons rather than as a communication of love for unselfish reasons, there are many evils that follow. And last week we talked about Pandora's box, another example of the same thing, same interpretation. That Eve, for a selfish reason, you see, for her sensual pleasure, what Freud calls autoerotic pleasure, really, even in this heterosexual relationship, they're both being autoerotic rather than relating, because you see, that's the symbolism of being told no. That this is selfish rather than unselfish. They're doing it against the law of God, or, you see, against the law of human nature, the way that sex is most beneficially used for happiness. So the phallic symbol tempts this naked woman, and what do? They share the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. Yes, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now, it's not an apple. According to dream interpretation, an apple is a symbol for a female breast. But this is something different. An apple is never mentioned in this story, is it? You can see why it's put in, because it fits in. You know, a breast symbol is much the same, but it's different. The knowledge of good and evil, the word to know, even, as I understand it, and I haven't checked the Hebrew or whatever, the same word is used when a woman is told to be fruitful and but the word knowledge, that when, for instance, the Virgin Mary says, how can I have a child, for I have not known man? That it's the same root word as the word knowledge used here in the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That the fruit-bearing tree, I just mentioned that, has often in the Bible been used as a symbol of woman. Be fruitful and multiply. And there are many other verses that I haven't really bothered to look up that have been told this is correct. That a fruit-bearing tree often refers to a fertile woman. That if it's the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, especially, the fruit of knowledge even, this refers to sex. But the knowledge of good and evil especially refers to sex, because sex itself becomes a symbol of either complete selfishness or complete unselfishness. So that what this part of the story is then is that this is a sexual relationship which is motivated by man's desire not to have experienced separateness. The symbol of re-entrance to the womb, or the re-entrance to the Garden of Eden, is not just to get back to the womb, but man's desire no longer to be separate from God or separate from the source and the sustaining force of his life, which is symbolized by the woman that you see that really exists while he was yet unborn. Now, what are some of the other parts of the story? Adam blames this on Eve when God, well, first they're naked and then they clothe themselves. This is what we refer to later on as the Cinderella syndrome. It's the same story as Cinderella, that when Cinderella's beautiful dress disappears and the beautiful coach changes into a pumpkin, the horses change to rats, they've had a sexual experience that brings shame upon them. And it's a very natural human reaction, that sex without love brings this. And the same thing happens to Adam and Eve. It's this Cinderella syndrome they experience. They clothe themselves and they're ashamed of God. Then when God comes, Adam blames Eve. It's her fault. And we talked about this as being interpreted in the same context, but in a slightly different fashion. You see, notice there are several other myths that tie in here. Not only Pandora's box, but even the fact that Eve was born whole from Adam's ribcage is much like the story of Zeus and Athena. It's much like the story of Little Red Riding Hood and her grandmother from the wolf, and we talked about that. There are many stories where a man is seen to be the one that really gives life, even though biologically and physiologically this is impossible. You see the birth, even not only of Eve from Adam, but of the world from God the Father. And yet, even though this is seen to be true, that man is the one that really originates this, he blames the woman. It's Pandora's fault. It's Eve's fault. It's all the evils of the world are blamed on her. Now, why is this? Now, the interpretation that we talked about is this one, that man sees himself in the act of courtship, much as many of the animal kingdom people do, like the lion who becomes the aggressive one in courtship for the female. That when the roles are reversed, and this is especially true outside of marriage or for a selfish reason, as was the case in Adam and Eve, when they're forbidden to have this courtship experience or this marriage experience. You see, Eve did it only to become godlike for a selfish reason, not to communicate love with Adam. That when the roles are reversed for this reason, and let's take an ordinary example, which I've seen many, many times in a sort of counseling relationship, where the girl, through her insecurity, seduces a boy that she has some feeling may provide the security for him, that terminates the relationship and he turns against her. He feels this role, the role of courtship is reserved for me, and when she seduces me, it turns me really against her, even though there may have been a relationship at first, a very close one. A male very commonly reacts negatively to being seduced by a woman, whether it's the fact that she initiates this by calling them up on the telephone, and when they're out on a date, she does the proposing, or whether it's, you see, anything. A real aggressive act by a female outside of marriage seems to be reacted to negatively by a male and causes many evils, not only in the relationship, but in the psychology of these two individuals, if they experience intercourse first. And we went through this in some detail, but basically this is the summary of the psychological interpretation of this story. And we didn't have time, it took the whole hour to do it. And what I asked for then is, are there any theologians here, or anyone schooled in theology, who could react to this and say whether or not the church would say this is absolutely wrong, or whether it might not be able to be fit into the, you see, that's where you come in, is that there was no time for this reaction last time, and I thought maybe we could discuss this first.
Talk about the flaming sword, though. You've left a big part of the story.
Oh, yeah. Which part of it?
The angel with the flaming sword that stands in front of the entrance. That's,
I need a match.
Yeah, isn't that what I was talking? I mentioned this part, didn't I?
Isn't that Oedipal?
What would it be?
No, I don't mean that. I would think to me, of course, everything you said is fairly common, as you know, together. And I would say almost all neo-Orthodox theologians, much less any other time, just accept this as being
except
a good
when
thing.
I asked you about the image of God in the fall,
right, then
you said they
that.
Both happen according to theologians, they both occur at creation.
According to Tillich and very liberal theologians, right. Now,
but this would say it happens not at creation, but the fall occurs at birth rather than conception. At creation is conception.
Well,
birth is the fall.
Let's talk about this in a minute. Yeah. First of all, isn't the angel with the flaming sword, following up your very excellent etiological analysis, which is what you're doing, it's a description of Arden, which essentially the myth as it came to the Hebrews from the Chalcedonians, from the Babylonians, and from others before them. By the way, I want to tell you the story of the fall of man as we can read it on the tablets from Babylon. It's very interesting. The man's name is Adapa, and in Babylonian that means man too. It's the same as Adam. But before I get to that, just to finish the logical interpretation.
Now, you said that the angel of flame is going to be Adapa. That's something that I don't see.
It's the whole prohibition against incest. Thou shalt not enter again.
Except, what's the incestual relationship here? Are you saying that Eve, being born of Adam, is his daughter, therefore?
No, but the incestuous relationship is, of course, as Freud, I think, wrote very heavily about, is one of the prime bases of the whole social structure of man, the whole
interior
structure.
We talked about this in the nature
of
Little Red Riding Hood and the other person you said, but I don't see it here.
I really think it is an incestual.
How did you just explain that?
Well, the whole idea, if you go back to the mythology of Freud, I mean, you have a counter-mythology, the herd, the primal herd, and
you tell
them about
the
death. Yeah, did you tell them about that? About the death of the father?
No. But I don't see how it's related to the angel flaming sword.
It is, because the angel of the flaming sword, under this form of interpretation, which is an etiology, therefore unscientific, I mean, it's a mythological reconstruction, which is quite beautifully done and very useful, would again stand for the sanctity of that place, if you will, that locus, and that end of the unstructured relationship.
How does this make it edible?
Makes it edible because, to be very brutally frank, if we assume that man had some sort of a social disorganization, such as talked about in Totem Taboo, man couldn't tell his mother from any other female. And most of the tragedies, many, many novels throughout man's history revolve just about this.
So you're saying that, well, this would be brought out just as clearly by the symbolism, you know, he's being born from Anna.
Yes, but not quite as blatantly. For example, how many of you saw the movie Tom Jones? How many of you got the implication of Molly, I think her name was, when she says, oops, when she was told who the father of Tom Jones was? How about that? You see, this is as old as man. It's one of the formulas.
Yeah, but why would they use the symbol of it? You see, what I
mean, sword. It's again, where do you get this business? Thou shalt not, you know, eat this apple or do whatever X it is involved. The flaming sword comes from the same place. I mean, it's from the apodictic storytelling.
Except what I'm saying is that these symbols are very close to the nature of man, and that we talk about how these are. You see, flaming sword has. Typically,
yes.
Not been interpreted to be a father.
I know what it would be interpreted as, I think. First of all, let me say this. You asked whether or not the theological tradition of the church was accepted.
Right.
I'd have to give a qualified yes and no if you talk about the broad stream of Catholic tradition coming from the early church through the great thinkers such as Augustine and into the Middle Ages and then down to the Scholastic period. The qualified yes would be this. In St. Augustine, if we read carefully there, we will see that he was quite familiar, for example, with the mythological literature of the classical period. He was heavily bent towards psychological or subjective interpretation, and in fact, he defines the Trinity in a subjective or psychological way.
Would you just...
But the first thing is this. He does not give, and of course we wouldn't expect it, to give an etiological, that is a reading back into the original meaning of a myth, interpretation of the fall. So the qualified yes would only be that he has tendencies in this direction. And throughout the history of theology, we find that for homiletical reasons, for educational reasons, you will find people who give what we might call pseudo-psychological explanations to the fall and to other things. But the unqualified no that would have to follow the qualified yes is that certainly no, not until the rise of what might be called extremely liberal religious thought, which would be probably the end of the 17th century, would you find anything of this nature acceptable to anyone known as a theologian. So, I mean, this is just to be fair and frank to the tradition. But secondly, in the modern period of the 19th and the 20th century, you will find that most theologians, except for those who are constitutionally determined that, you know, the universe's foundation rested upon some literal acceptance of these stories in the Bible and in the traditions, most theologians, at a minimum, spoke out of two sides of their mouth when they wrote about these things. Yes, this is the word of God. Yes, this is literal. And yet, on the other hand, they would begin, for pastoral reasons, as much as anything else, to utilize them, to use them, you know, in a teaching way, in a helping way, to give what you might call pseudo a scientific, a pseudo-psychological interpretation for them.
Now, one of the main points in this story, it seems to me, that we're, and what you said, that some of these things are common, but one thing that no one else has ever written about that I've been able to find, or I've researched it, and maybe you've come across one and I haven't been able to, and you could tell me, and then
which element?
the part that the symbolism that really differentiates here from creation and fall.
Now that's why I didn't answer that question yet.
That creation begins at conception and the fall begins at birth. That is new and original just to this psychological interpretation.
It's a mistake.
Now why would it be? That's what I'm saying.
It's a mistake because if we take it ontologically, as we were talking this morning, in other words, about, not first of all, what ontology means. Ontology means the study of being, that is, of existence. Ontos means to be, being, in Greek. The study of sheer existence, sheer facticity of being there, as they say in German, Dasein. Now, taking it ontologically, of course, the scripture itself talks about this, as we say, ex nihilo, out of nothing. In other words, the impression is, and of course, this is language that means nothing factually, it means everything. By way of intention, though, at one moment, you know, what kind of a moment we're talking about? There is nothing in that moment. There is the universe. Ex nihilo, just suddenly, God has expressed himself in this way, that there is the universe. Now, you cannot, therefore, then speak of a phylogenetic, you cannot speak of an ontogenetic, you cannot speak of a biological process of nine months in the womb in this kind of a situation.
Except you can, yes. Because what we're doing here is looking, we're saying psychologically, and maybe the theologians would have to take this as a differing point.
And here we've
psychologically, yeah. Psychologically, a person would think this of the birth process. That from, that really from nothing, conception, I mean. That really from nothing, here is life. That life has been created from nothing in a sense. Sure, there's the material of the sperm and the egg. But there's a real sense, even theologically we say, there's been a soul really from nothing given to these two material substances.
The only person who would say that would be Neil Thomas. That's a Catholic doctor.
You mentioned St. Thomas Aquinas as one of these theologians.
I'm talking about today, and Neil Thomas would say
but
that.
But see, why psychologically would not this be what this dream symbolism is? From nothing here is a life. There's been a spiritual.
I have no argument. I think it's a very useful teaching tonight.
But now, why wouldn't it be possible to look at the difference between creation and the fall, or to look at the doctrine of original sin in this psychological matter, discarding some of the things, therefore, that might have been done in other ways? Right. Would this be valid, in fact?
There's only one problem, I would think this, and they're very serious. I would prefer the unbroken myth to the broken myth in this point, if you're going to press that point, although I think it's certainly and highly in accord with most everything that you've said and have done this in a layman's way. All of my teaching years and so as everyone else I know in whatever particular doctrinal tradition. But the one thing that would worry me about it is this. The second assumes more gullibility and credibility than the first myth, because we must recognize that this is a re-mythologization. This is not a scientific demonstration. It is a re-mythologization. Now, insofar as the mythology of our time is essentially the eclectic mythology that has been delivered to us by some rather great intellects such as Freud and Jung, for example, who goes much, much further mystically, and whom I like much better, frankly, but we are living in a so-called psychological age, and we understand we are not talking about science in the terms of assured fact. Such as I say that a bar of lead weighs 31 pounds, you know, and you can measure it, but that these are the intentions that perhaps whatever authors contribute to these things.
See, we're doing this the same way as a dream, where there's take, say, something like Little Red Riding Hood. Whoever made the story of Little Red Riding Hood, what did they intend? What do they really mean? Very different. Why not the same with Adam and Eve? What difference does it make?
I see nothing wrong with that. Nothing whatsoever. As long as we see this, that we do think, now, aha, here is the scientific truth or something like that. There's no question of scientific truth in such matters. But when you say, here is certainly what would have consciously or unconsciously be in the intention.
Right.
correct. And I don't see that we have any other choice but to do something of the kind that you're doing.
And if we did this, wouldn't it be possible to look at this doctrine of original sin in this way? Why would this way be worse than the way that it's commonly been done, as I understand?
Let me say why I said the solution. I said that I would prefer the unbroken myth to the broken myth now. For this reason. It tends to overlook the deeper metaphysical issues involved about existence. It tends, under this ideological, psychological interpretation, to make sin essentially social. Because for the assumption that this myth seeks...
No, it doesn't.
It intends to make it social, which is a misunderstanding.
That's a misunderstanding of this interpretation.
Let me tell you how I misunderstand it, then you can correct me.
Dear moderator.
It intends, in its explanation, to say, you know, here's a description of the birth process, and here it has its ramifications also for sexuality.
No, it doesn't.
Well, wait a minute.
In a sense, it does, but not this way.
Well, wait a minute.
It says sin is separation from God or from the source of love.
I'll let you tell me whether it's sense or nonsense in a minute. Let me tell you first. It assumes that someone, we say God because that's the term that figures in the original, that's certainly acceptable. But if we're taking it now as a description of the birth process and so forth, we would have to say some older human being who says to the child or to the young man and young woman, thou shalt not, or at least they draw from social intercourse the very deep and very meaningful and true insight that sex without commitment is a demonic thing. This is what you have hammered at.
But that is not the point of the story.
The point of the story is that they know, they have an apodictic commandment, that is, thou shalt not eat of that tree, or thou shalt not have this intercourse. And consequently, then the whole thing is set in the motif, set in the place of a societal stream. Oh. And it makes this original sin
is
a societal sin.
No, it doesn't. The entire point of original sin does not have a thing to do with intercourse.
That is the way you're explaining it.
No, it is not. Let me explain how it's being explained. At creation or conception, man is in the image and likeness of God and is good. But at birth, original sin develops because of his separation from the source
of love. That's exactly what I said. Alienation is strangeness.
That's exactly what this myth says. Right. But then what happens? Man wants not to have this alienation continue.
Right.
And at birth, he's of course narcissistic, egocentric. Mm-hmm. But one of the ways he sees as a way of overcoming this separateness then is, and then we get into Freud's
through intercourse.
But in what way can intercourse be used? It can be either used autoerotically, as Eve did, and that is a thou shalt not.
Right.
Or it can be used in the way Freud talks about it as being fulfilling, heterosexual, where it's an attraction for good.
You don't have to go to Freud. You can go to Augustine here, to one of the great theologians.
And then this story
makes
sense.
Talk about love being used, you know, properly and improperly.
And Freud,
of course it makes sense.
And in Freudian theory, he even goes further and talks, why is it? Why is it that at birth there's this alienation? And Freud talks about it in libidinal energy.
Well,
man is conceived with eros, this life instinct. Frustration, any kind of frustration, including separation.
Let me give you a theological term and see if you will accept this.
Okay.
Essentially, the early portion of the story in the garden, which is the womb, is union with God. It's the gnosis.
Yes, yes. And mother is the revelation of God for the child.
And man is separated then from God. He becomes aware of this.
Right.
He wants to get back to God.
This means
that's exactly what I was saying. Ontologically speaking.
Yes.
Notice
how this story then makes much more clear the doctrine of original sin. Remember when I asked you that question, you said the theologians only say it happens at the same time. Now they could really look at it and say it might not. It might be that the image and likeness of God is from conception to, and it makes the Catholic doctrine of limbo much more acceptable. That if a baby dies
God
before
forbid,
birth,
I want to fight it. Then if that's
See, this might be psychologically what they're saying.
Yeah, we don't want to take and manufacture explanations where we don't need them.
Except if we have an explanation and then we can fit facts into this theory, It makes the theory more plausible.
I think if you take it as an anthropological symbol now, is say, this is how man, we, you know, men at the end of this stream of development, you know, from the animal kingdom and so forth, this is the way it comes to us. I agree with you exactly. But now what I'm saying is that you're overlooking entirely then the ontological referent, which is obviously also implied, that is,
which?
The original creation of which man formed no part.
Right, if that's what I, that's another point, this theory of condensation.
Yeah.
One myth might have several meanings. See, this
right.
guy just wrote in David 8, what
right.
does he say?
Yeah.
Man leaving the Garden of Eden, it's when he leaves the forest into the prairies. I mean, there are hundreds of
right.
them. But what I'm saying is this particular interpretation right. helps to explain original sin.
And that is exactly why I will say I agree with you, and I think most younger theologians would of whatever tradition, although probably professionally many would be forced not to do so in public.
But this story has never been published in this meaning.
It's good. You're quite mistaken, I think.
If you can show me one reference where it is said that the Garden of Eden is the woman at birth, is this, and that it refers to
I think you'll find it in the Bollingen series, volume 21 of the Collected Works of Jung. The Bollingen series.
I don't think so. I've checked out Jung, but I'll go back. And he talks about this sexual thing, but he does not talk about creation being conception, the fall being birth.
Well, this is a private scholarly. We don't want to.
I'll check it again, but I have checked this reference. Volume 21, you say.
I think that's it.
Well, I'll check again. I've got the Collected Works of Jung.
Good, beautiful. I'll borrow them from you. I wanted to say first about the myth of Adapa. I think some of you probably heard it before. According to the Babylonian Genesis, which is the name given to it by scholars, there was a god, Ea, and of course there was another god, Tiamat, as I recall, who was less than nice. So that you have a dualism there. You have good and you have evil from the primordial beginnings of everything. And Ea brings into existence a son. He is his Son of God, his name is Adapa, and man. And man is a fisherman in the story. He lives approximately the Persian Gulf or something, and he makes his life. He needs a helpmeet, and in a somewhat similar manner, he has a helpmeet. But one thing comes to this fisherman as he fishes, and this is just a very generalized statement of the story. He noticed that he kills the fish as he catches them, and he eats them. And that the fish eat each other. And that the universal cycle seems to be, you know, life only exists because death is there. And so it worries him, it troubles him, and he comes to the nostrils of Ea and his sacrifices that this man is troubled. And so he decides that he will withhold nothing from his children, but he will give them everything as good. So in the council of the gods and the demons and the spirits, he asks for a cup of immortality. And it is presented to Ea, but along with another cup. Now, the idea is that Adapa, as Adam, and this is another element of the myth, is in some kind of limbo, if you want to put it. He is in some kind of neuter state. You remember, you've done very little with the death business here, death as a result of sin. That is a question as to whether he is going to live forever or whether he's going to die. This is just undecided. If he knew, perhaps he wouldn't have the anxiety. But according to the divine way of doing things, one does not offer the cup of immortality unless he also offers the cup of mortality. And the two cups are very clearly marked and labeled, and they are taken by an angel or cherubim or something to Adapa. And Adapa, now the fall occurs. He doesn't know whether to trust the label on the cup or not. he is in a quandary. I often think about it when I've read and studied the story about Jesus. Would a father give his son a serpent if he asked for a fish, or a stone if he would give him an egg? I think our experience tells us a lot of fathers probably would. And it's a harmful thing to say the truth. And so Oedipus does not know what to do. And a serpent comes into this story. And the serpent tricks Oedipus. This is one of the most deep symbols in the history of religions. And Jung writes about this, the trickster, because the devil is a joker in the history of religions.
But notice this is a man that he's speaking to, not Oedipus.
Yeah, he's speaking to the man, right? And it is a snake.
Very important. Yeah,
of course it is. It is a snake, I suppose. It is
a snake. Ages.
Yeah, you can't tell about those Babylonians, though. In any event, the snake tricks him into making the wrong choice by telling him he certainly can trust Ea. Ea means earth, universe. He certainly can trust him. And you know, if cup A, you know, says immortality, boy, drink that cup. Drink it, you know. And so he convinces Oedipus, you better drink cup B. And he does. And is wild weeping in heaven. And the floods and the seas rise because God cries because man made the wrong choice. And from that, the story goes on. Of course, the reason why the snake also, it isn't only his size that figures him in these primordial myths, but the fact that among primitive peoples, we know through anthropological studies to this day, the snake is considered to be immortal because he sheds his skin in the season and takes on a new skin. In other words, it's so easy to be pan-Freudian, who was pansexual, and I have all respect for Freud, but you know, there are other kinds of symbols than sexual symbols. The snake is a symbol of immortality, which perhaps the phallus is too, I don't know, but we must remember
that's
that.
A very good point. I just kind of,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
There's a very close symbolism here.
Close symbolism, exactly.
If we talk about procreation and species, this is, I don't think it in any way discounts this.
But what is also involved in the area that I would, you know, say that, again, I agree with you, your interpretation of this myth sequence, and it's really not just
notice again the way this ends, that one of the things that, and the one that is most directly mentioned is from now on, the woman must have pain in childbearing.
Yes, that's one that we didn't get to, but of course we need to. But I'm more concerned with the one about death, because you see, the assumption is, and this is a New Testamental emphasis
again,
on the fall.
Right,
yeah.
And I think very
the
important here, what happens when a child is born? He is now incapable of sustaining his own life and has no source to do it unless mother now extrinsically ministers to him. Instead of intrinsically, you know, as part of, I think that's very...
That's important, I'm sure, but I would think much more important is the fact that the moment we are born, that is the moment we begin to die.
Right, and then see, it ties in with the same...
Can I borrow another mat from somebody?
Then go ahead.
Who's starting?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, the evenly react violently to your egotistic masculine.
No, I want to take up the Eve all the time.
Your egotistic masculine presumption that woman, that this first intercourse was woman's instigation, and that it was,
autoerotic,
not wanting relationship. Because this goes against the very nature of woman. Woman is the one who gets tricked all the time. she's the one who wants relatedness. It's man who hits and runs.
I hope you brought your pistol this morning.
Notice though what really happens. I'm sure that's true, that what woman really wants is a relationship. But notice what she's doing in this story, and what's the point I'm really trying to make. That in this story, what she really is doing, that if you want to put it in a different way, instead of saying autoerotic, you must say it's selfish. that this is not the way it's been ordained by.
That's your presumption.
Well, what I'm saying, no.
It's a new myth.
Of course, and he's tripping over his assumption of ordination here too, apodictic, this solid law, you know, goodness. Laws don't come before the fact, laws come after we make mistakes. You know?
Except in this particular myth, this is something that when he does it, she knows is forbidden by God. This is not something that he said not to do. Now what does this indicate? I mean, that's part of the myth. Now how can it be interpreted? See, that's what we do is we take the dream or the myth, and we say, this is the way it is. Now what can this mean? What is this? We know, I mean, there are certain things that it must not mean. That here is he, having been told by God, you must not share this fruit, you must not eat of it. The serpent tells her, yes, you should eat of it, because if you do, it will make you more godlike. See, this is part of the story. Now, how do we interpret that? What I'm saying is one possible interpretation is that the commandment of God that you shouldn't do it indicates that when she did this, she was doing it not for a reason that would fulfill the law of God, but one contrary to it, meaning that she was acting selfishly rather than unselfishly. Now, see, in ordinary life, I've seen this happen many times. The woman might indeed be doing this in order to find a relationship, but not to communicate love, in order to make her more secure when she is not being loved, but she really, it does not have concern for the male, but for herself only.
It's called legal prostitution.
Well, you see, and really, this I've seen it happen. I could, you know, really, and just many of the girls that come talk to me, this is what's happened. That they, in fact, have seduced this guy because they are so insecure. And they really don't care about this guy. They just want security. And sure, it's a relationship, but they're not doing it for an unselfish reason. They're
well,
doing
if,
it.
If you're going to carry this wanting to get back and do and all that, well, then you can't leave out things. Maybe Eve, why doesn't anybody ever say anything about Eve wanting to get back in that rib cage?
Yes, that's I think it's a good point, and I didn't mean to leave it out. But you see, well, Plato. No, really, there is a big, I think that's a very, very important point. And
you left it out.
Well, maybe I did this time. I think I spoke to this last week.
I want a clinical description of that, by the way.
No, really, this is, let me explain
it
to you.
I mean, why do you concentrate on the penis and the uterus?
Okay, exactly, good point. Here's what this...
The rib cage is beautiful, too.
Right. really, this is a very, very important point. The woman, notice this different symbolism here. What is the rib cage really symbolized for a woman? I suppose some of the modern women say, well, it's really a cage that they're trapped in, you know, because in this relationship they're at home and all. But it really is something much more significant, I think. That a woman really wants in this relationship a real security that's very womb-like, only symbolized by the rib cage. In fact, the woman's most greatest, and this I think can really be shown by a lot of the research done, a woman's most, if she's not just doing this to communicate love, her second most powerful motivation for sex is security. And we could go on and talk many ways that this is true for the woman, but not true for the man. A man's motivated by curiosity.
It is security. You don't want security.
Lots of the studies will show maybe, at least, what is she trying to do? She's trying to get back, I mean, if we're saying this is the thing, she wants to get back inside the rib cage. It's a very good symbol of a very secure place that, you know, surrounded by this man and at least lots of the studies have shown that a woman's main motivation outside of communication with love is for security.
Means that I say forget that I said, but things like rib cage.
I think that's a very secondary interpretation of it. I mean, it seems to me much more important, is practically the same meaning as the Babylonian myth, namely the idea that you know better. You say that God tells you such and such place, and then you can't take God's word. You say you have to interpret
that's
God's word your way.
Very good interpretation.
So you see, Eve is the
but
first
to be I'm really curious about it. I really want to know what you think the main motivation is of a woman for sex, if it's not security or communication of love.
Well, I don't happen to think the main point of the story necessarily has to be sex. I think the
let's assume it's not.
The main point of the story as it's laid out is knowledge, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's a knowledge of good and evil. In other words, it's something ethical and moral. And I really think we can't overlook that. And I do think, as much as I enjoy, and as much as I think, you know, you're in the main position of homiletics, of interpreting this, and I do commend you, leaving out the whole business of mortality and immortality.
This guy gives a compliment. It's very funny to hear that in the back
I think it's very important that we don't overlook the fact of his connection with death, because this is a real theological problem of how does death figure in the agency of humanity and the agency of God and the universe? What is its function? And you see, this myth sequence, and I repeat again, it's not just one myth, but it's several of them joined together in a particular way. This myth sequence pretends, at least, or offers in its intention, an explanation, not just of why there are briars in the world, you know, that's mentioned in there, not just why man has to work so hard to grub a living out of the ground, but an explanation of why death is a terror. And, you know, I'm not at all saying that we die because we sin. This is what St. Paul says, however. But I'm saying this, we have to come to grips with theological facts of death. And this would be the real weakness I would see in this. Not that it is weak in itself, although you got new points, but it doesn't go far enough.
I think it could. We could easily push and say that death and birth really are the same
thing.
But I want to really, and I know the bells ring, but I really want to find out what you think a woman's name is.
What
bell
was that? That was the proof,
yeah.
No.
We have a half hour
for it. Could you? I really, I very much respect your opinion. I think you may have an insight, but I haven't seen it yet. What would a woman's main motivation be for sex, do you think?
I think it's for sex.
Well, for intercourse, isn't that what you said? Here's what you said. I really don't, you know, I think you're putting all the blame on women that you're saying that. I'm forgetting what you said, but it seems to me like what you were saying is that a woman would not be motivated for sex for reasons of security. Didn't you say that? Or did
no, I want to. I would rather talk about what a woman wants in a man.
Well, could you also make that include what would she, why would she desire sex with a particular man?
I think the sex comes, what does a woman want in a man? Why are you married?
And I'm saying security is the main reason.
You don't know. Security, and you don't marry for sex. You marry for a communion of spirit, I think. And the sex falls away, it diminishes. It does. It diminishes in the woman, and it diminishes the man, too, I think.
Yes, and don't last.
and then I think if there were a holocaust and all the material security were to be blasted, and there wouldn't be any material security, I think what a woman wants ultimately is communion with a companion and with a man.
For what purpose?
And the sex is the I don't know.
Well, let me just ask you this: are you saying here are two possibilities, and I really am asking this because I really want to know your opinion. I know what the psychologists say already about this.
Well, let me finish it. I mean, Howard are here.
He'd give you security, wouldn't he?
No. He would be the other side of her.
He would articulate what I'm trying to say. See, I feel he articulates. But I think in the ideal marriage, why you have the mental and the spiritual union, and the sexual union comes as a fruit of the mental and the spiritual union. And that's why many marriages fail, because it's first the sexual attraction, and that falls away, and there's nothing left in vain when you get to work.
So what you're really saying then is that mainly sex is a communication of love.
Yes.
A union of spirits.
And a woman wants in a man not his sex, not his security. She wants a communion of spirit.
I agree completely, but I'm saying that.
See, the lady in the play last night obviously had a lot of security, but it wasn't enough.
No, she didn't, I don't think.
No, she had material security. Well, you're suggesting that that's all.
Oh, I apparently had a sex
Really, what I meant to say though is that there are two main motivations for sex. One of them is unselfish, and that is in order to communicate love. But most people in the world do not use sex for that purpose. Most of them use it for a selfish purpose. And whatever they do for a selfish purpose, evils follow. Except she did this against the will of God and was forbidden by him. And that's
a new myth.
But it's in this
one. And you're really deep down in the myth now, because of course on its surface it doesn't talk about sex.
In the traditional interpretation of Genesis, I mean, in fact, the Father's Church has always had a strong sort of tying in of sex. It was quite often said that the first intercourse took place immediately after the fall. The fathers tended to think that if it hadn't been for the fall, people would have reproduced some other way.
That's precisely right.
Sexuality there's a long tradition of sort of tying this in with the beginning.
And notice how the apple has been brought in.
Of sexuality.
Originally not there, but later on
The apple comes in naturally, because also in the Babylonian tablets there's a story about the tree of life. And it was a fruit tree. I don't know whether it was a pear or an apple or a pan.
Let me tell you this. A pear in Jewish interpretation is a symbol of the uterus.
I know.
An apple is a symbol of the breast.
Yes.
So these very closely fit in.
And of course, we still have the tree in the Christmas tree, which Martin Luther, that glorious German pagan, brought back in the Christmas. And really, one of the people who went along with the Reformation, at the time of the Reformation, made a quip that way. For 400 years, we fought to get the sacred tree out of Germany, and Luther brought it in overnight. That's interesting.
Bonhoeffer's little thing, Creation and Fall, ties in, sex and fall in his particular way. But he uses it the authentic nature of man is communion with God, communion with the brother, and that's just the two sides of the same thing. And then the fall is always a falling out of communion with God, which is also falling out of communication with the brother. But there's no kind of one-way thing here. It's an exploitive relation arises on both sides.
Well, see, that's what I'm really saying. In this particular story,
the male relationship becomes exploitive.
It's no longer a communication of love, but it's really she's seeking something else for herself rather than a.
I'm not just saying the sin creates exploitive relationships between human beings.
Why don't you stop mixing religious and psychological metaphors and stop saying against the will of God and saying against
the nature of
herself?
Well, that's of course what it means.
Otherwise, she violates herself,
right,
as we violate ourselves in prostitute-like relationships. Anytime we misuse the good. But of course, then it would be much theologically sounder, not just because we drop out the idea of the will of God, but because we come to the point that sin really is the misuse of good.
Right. Well, this is again something that I think the psychologists are beginning to say when they talk with religious people, at least, that the will of God and the nature of man, that true humanity, true
divinity
are the same, really. That what God really, if we talk theologically, what God really has in mind for us is our perfect humanity, and that these rules lead us towards perfect humanity as well as union with God. So that's why we interchange the two. I mean, that's why I interchange them here, that they really mean the same thing. That the will of God is for perfect humanity, but
the fact that this is an interpretation that has a long religious history ought to be borne in mind by the fact of the Asherah and the pillars and the female organ.
Except that the one difference, the one very important difference, is what you first started attacking, is saying that it was sex, that was the sin that was the evil. And I'm not saying that at all.
No, you're talking about a misuse, of course. But I mean,
yes,
the fact that
yes,
the
and that's
nature
why
of religion
is important to look at it.
The nature of religion.